tonight on Arena. New albums from PJ Harvey, Anunay and the Johnsons and Lucinda Williams up for review, and writer Sam Ford and actor Rory Lenihan on the play Emergency. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we start this evening with theatre reviews. Fun Home, musical theatre adaptation of Alison Bechdel's graphic memoir of the same name. It's written by Lisa Crone. It went on to win 5 Tony Awards in 2015, including Best Musical and Best Original Score. The story concerns Bechdel's discovery of her own sexuality, her relationship with her closeted gay father, and her attempts to unlock the mysteries surrounding his life. Fun Home opened at the Gate Theatre in Dublin last night with Frances McNamee and Killian Donnelly in the leading roles and directed by Róisín McBryn. Helen Meaney attended the performance and she's with me in studio now. I suppose I kind of had to check this with you beforehand. Bechdel, Alison Bechdel, it is Alison Bechdel of the Bechdel, the famous Bechdel test.
It is she, yes, of the Bechdel test, which probably many people have heard of long before they may have heard of Fun Home, certainly on this side of the water. The Bechdel test was a joke that she introduced in her comic strip, which is a very feminist and lesbian comic strip, about was a critique of the portrayal of female characters in cinema in general, on screen. They said, her friend apparently actually did say this to her, that I will only go and see a film if there is a scene in which two women are talking to each other alone and they are not talking about a man. Yeah. And it's funny and clever and it sums up, there's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah, and of course
it certainly was.
Yeah, yeah, it started as a kind of a joke, but in fact has become something, a real measure of a film in many ways.
And it became one of those, it went into the currency and became a sort of a shorthand. Same Alison Bechdel.
So it's her story long before any Bechdel test or anything like it. We go right back to her childhood. Who are we talking about when we talk about the young Alison Bechdel?
So the young Alison Bechdel is a child growing up in Pennsylvania in a small town in the 70s. And she's her father runs a funeral home. And the kids, she and her brothers, call this the Fun Home. So there's a lot of black humor about that. And he's a very kind of dominant, charismatic figure, and he has a huge interest in interior design, in the beautiful house that they live in, that he's restored to its 19th century interior and detail. He's a really strong character and volatile. And so
so that's the 1970s, which is one of the three timelines. There are three timelines involved here.
That's right. So this is based on Bechdel's own graphic novel where she tells this story,
the memoir,
of where she came from. And it's the story of her coming out as a lesbian at the age of 19, 20. And we also see the older Alison, the writer and cartoonist, on the stage as well. So there are three Alisons on stage. Yeah.
So the kind of the young girl and it's preteen, then the 19-year-old when she
going to college and very 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 quickly realizing at university that she's gay and coming back and telling her parents.
Yeah. And then the older, the 40-year-old Alison looking back.
That's
the fact
right.
That this is considered a family tragic comedy. Yes, it's a comedy, but there's a tragic bit in there as well.
Yes, there is, and it relates to her father, Bruce, who is gay but closeted. So some people know he is, and obviously his wife does. But this is the sort of bond between father and daughter. But this is related at the beginning of the production, the show. So I'm not not spoiling it by saying that he walks out in front of a truck and kills himself. Only a matter of months after the young Alison goes home and tells him and her mother that she is gay and is proudly, clearly identifying as such. The questions for the older Alison, the writer and cartoonist, is,
quite enormous.
Was this a reaction to his daughters coming out and being able to be so open about it, while he had spent his whole life trying to keep it a secret. Not very well kept secret, by the way.
How intelligent, how bright a young girl was the young Alison?
Oh, really bright, curious, lively. She was drawing. She already showed this talent for drawing. And her father, who obviously had aesthetic sensibility and an interest in art and design, as well as in literature, he was trying to steer her away from what she was good at, which was being a cartoonist. Mm. That was her own gift. And he wanted her to be more of a fine art. He kept saying, well, that's not a drawing. So the part of this story is not only her coming out as gay, but it's also her emergence as an artist,
as a cartoonist
and a graphic artist, which was her finding her own path and for which she became and is really famous.
Let's have a listen to it. I think this is from the very opening of the play, in fact, but it's from the Tony Awards ceremonies in 2015 when Fun Home won those two awards, Best Original Score, wasn't it, and Best Musical. So it's the opening scene, and we'll just play a little bit of it. Gives a sense, because it is a musical, gives a sense of the sort of musical that we're talking about.
I wanna play airplane. I wanna play airplane. I wanna play airplane. I wanna put my arms out and fly like the Red Baron in a soundproof camel. No, wait. Like Superman up in the sky till I can see all of Pennsylvania.
Caption: my dad and I were exactly alike.
I see everything.
Caption: my dad and I were nothing alike.
So that's the very opening scene of Fun Home, and that from the, as I said, the Tony Award ceremonies of 2015. The play or the musical opened at the Gate Theatre in a totally new production, or at least in an Irish production of this particular play, and Helen Meaney was there for us. Is it re-realising the Tony Award winning production, or has it been totally reimagined?
Oh, this is a new production, the first Irish production, and it's directed by Roisin McBrien, and on the Gate stage, and with it's an entirely original
and live
piece.
Music?
Live music with the ensemble raised on the balcony at the back of the stage. And so there's a lot going on. The stage is a series of, frames, which represents or denotes, I suppose, the frames of the cartoon page. So in the beginning, I thought, they're very boxed in. And then I realised why that was.
Of course.
And they're using
the characters in some ways,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, it works really well, because Alison, the cartoonist writer, introduces her memories with the word caption. So she's writing it
as a graphic novel.
As a visual image. Yeah. So she thinks through images, and you can see, so the script really cleverly shows that she's conjuring these memories on the page.
So it's acknowledging that it is an adaptation of that graphic.
Oh yes,
that's memory.
Completely central to it, and we get projections of some of her line drawings.
So an exciting presentation.
Yes, it's a very creative setting,
and
it's a difficult thing to do, because there are layers and layers to it. Not only the past and present, the two different pasts and the present, but also the themes are layered, and it's not simplistic.
Killian Donnelly plays Alison's father, the tragic part of the tragic comedy of the title. How does he manage with that?
Really well, really, really well. He's got the comic timing for the lighter numbers at the beginning, where they're all pretending to be a happy family.
Yeah.
And then he has a great kind of meltdown scene at the end, very shortly before he dies, where he can't keep up the pretense of living a lie, and everything, all this emotion is bursting out. And no, he's really good. He holds the stage. But what I loved about this actually is that it's not a play about him. It is definitely Alison's story,
even though he's part of it.
Trying to understand her relationship him.
We get three versions of Alison. I think they're described as small, medium, and
Medium, and then just Alison.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So there's obviously young kind of teenager and then the adult Alison.
And the medium Alison gets that moment of going off to university, that freedom, that transformation, self-discovery. So she's carrying a lot of that that emotional weight of it. Yeah. And she goes back and tells her parents that she has come out. And she's Orla Scally, and she's excellent.
Yeah, Orla Scally is that the medium one who carries the
very
the can.
Awkward, very shy, very kind of, and then she falls in love and she has sex with a woman for the first time and she is so deliriously happy. It's actually a gorgeous performance.
And Nicola McAvilly plays the mother here.
She's excellent too. And I was a bit worried that we weren't getting enough of her perspective, but then just towards the end, she has a scene with Alison where we hear this lovely song called Days and Days, which she describes what her whole married life has been like, living a lie and trying to cover up for her husband.
And we do, obviously, there are different children playing the different parts because we get those younger ones on various nights.
Yes. On opening night, it was Jodie Kay, and she was superb,
Young Alison.
She really was.
Small Alison.
Small Alison. And she has a couple of solo numbers herself, and she carried them very, very well.
And I suppose it's important to point out there's an age of 12 plus on the guidance from the Gate Theatre. Is this this is it for teens and adults?
Teens and adults. There's no explicit sex really. It's all decorous, but it is of course an adult theme, and particularly the suicide of their father. So what comes across is that Alison's liberation and self discovery is really on the back of what her father went through, that each generation's kind of discovery
sounds
of themselves.
Like a recommendation.
It
for
is,
you,
yeah. It, there's a lot going on. There's a lot going on, and it's really well staged.
Okay,
yeah.
That's Helen Meaney on Fun Home. This production runs until Saturday, August the 26th, so right through the summer period, effectively, at the Gate Theatre in Dublin. Full information on gatetheatre.ie. Now on at Bewley's Cafe in Grafton Street in Dublin, indeed all over the cafe, is a play called Emergency, a promenade-style one-man show in which head waiter Joseph, or is he Yosef?
It would be Yosef.
Yosef, yeah, I'm just checking across with the man who's playing Rudy Lennon, who plays him. Meant to check that with you beforehand. It takes the audience on a tour of the beautiful old building, pointing out interesting features while talking about the war in Europe and the man who is wrecking the continent. The year is 1941. The stories are funny, they're sad, and they're bittersweet. Rory Lenehan, as you've heard, plays the character of Yosef, and the script is by Sam Ford. Rory is with me in studio now, and Sam joins us on the line from Kerry. I'm not sure exactly what you're doing down in Kerry at the moment, Sam, but I know that you are a tour guide as well as a theatre maker. So, in fact, that really feeds in to the nature of the play that you've written here. It's almost as if Yosef, the character, is bringing us of a guided tour of Bewley's in 1941.
Yes, indeed. I suppose the opening section, the main character Yosef, he's furious with the audience that they're somewhere they shouldn't be. They're in an area that's been closed off since October 1940 and will remain closed for the duration of the war, and he sort of scolds them and realizes that they're special visitors, so he kind of has to go a bit easier on them then, and he's trying to find a particular colleague who's supposed to be bringing them around, and that's the premise for them moving all around the building.
Yeah, because it is, as I said, it's a promenade type of performance where Rory Lenehan, who's with me here as Yosef, literally walks the audience around the place. In some ways, without giving too much away, the Balazs character that they're constantly trying to find, he's kind of the MacGuffin of the piece in some ways, Rory, isn't he?
The mysterious Balazs. He's a bit of a rogue waiter in the place. He likes to sneak off for extended cigarette breaks with British Army personnel from the north.
Because we're in 1941.
We're
in that period in time. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about Yosef Kellner.
That's right. So they're both refugees, really. They've both fled Austria, Vienna, in 1938, just when the Germans were marching in, basically, when he got out. He's come to Dublin. That's where he's ended up. He's a lot of experience working in the Viennese-style coffee houses. And so he feels very at home when he lands in Grafton Street at Bewley's, and it's really a home from home for him, and he gets to work and works his way up to head waiter there. And that's where we meet him then.
Yeah. And Sam, was there some semblance of reality or a character in reality who was the starting point for you in the writing of this play?
Yeah, so Bewley's Cafe itself, as distinct from Bewley's Cafe Theatre, they got me in as an artist in residence, and their very loose brief was to do something that would engage playfully with the history of the building. And I went off reading about the Bewleys and the Quakers back to 1840 and bringing tea from China and all this. And then I happened upon a story of this Hungarian refugee who came over in 1956 and created what we now know as the Mary Cake, which has been a fixture on the Bewley's menu ever since. It's a very, very rich chocolate cake. And then I was kind of reading about the emergency, Bewley's during the 1940s, all the kind of ersatz ingredients that they had to use and shortages in general. And this was all around the time of the outbreak of the war in Ukraine. So I kind of kept seeing all these parallels. You know, there was wheat shortages and fuel shortages. And I decided that this real life Hungarian refugee who created this chocolate cake, I decided to just bring him back by about 15 years to 1941. And that was the inspiration for Joseph.
Yeah, and as you say, that period being, of course, the emergency, as it was referred to here in the Republic of Ireland, and emergency being the title of the play. But what's interesting, Rudy, is you literally, as Joseph, bring people on a guided tour, not just of the cafe itself, but out onto the street and in and around other buildings. Some very interesting buildings, it has to be said. But let's say inside just for the time being, and talk to us a little bit, if you would, about White's School and where that fits into the story.
Yeah, so that part of the building that we move through from the James Joyce room, we go up there and it was formerly a school, Dr. White's, otherwise known as the Seminary for the Instruction of Youth. And they had some very famous pupils in their day. Richard Brinsley Sheridan, the playwright, of course. Thomas Moore, the songwriter. Robert Emmet, the revolutionary. And the Duke of Wellington himself, who was born just around the corner, actually, up the road from there. And and my character is doing a little bit of teaching himself in that area, in coffee training and... So he leads them down, and then we do a little bit of a waiter training exercise with someone there.
So there is a little bit of audience participation.
A little bit now. I wouldn't get too scared of it. They seem to love it now in general, and they like to get involved, you know.
Yeah, because you've been running, I think, since maybe the middle of June.
Yes, we picked off on the 19th of June. Yeah,
and you're running right through the summer period, really, into August. The other location that's important within the story here, Sam, is Johnson's Court. This is St. Teresa's Church, which was built in 1797. What was the interest in that building for you? Because you're going to bring the audiences out and around to look at these places as well.
Well, ostensibly, this Balash man, who's always, you know, mitching off work, this is his favourite smoking spot. So Joseph brings them out there in a big hurry, convinced that he's going to catch him in the act of smoking, and he's just left. So then Joseph can't help but explaining a few bits and pieces. But I suppose timing-wise is interesting because it's 1 year before the 1798 rebellion. It was 30 years before the Bewleys imported the... Sorry, 30 years before Catholic emancipation and 40 years before the Bewleys imported the first ever tea chests to Dublin direct from China. And they say that that's one of the reasons that the Irish drink the second highest volume of tea per head of any country in Europe, with the Turks being just ahead of us.
Yeah, so it's all Bewley's fault.
It's all Bewley's fault that there were complete tea maniacs in this country, yeah.
Maybe we could hear a little piece from the play itself, Rory. We're a bit into it at this time, but it gives us a flavour, I suppose, of the period, and it mentions a very important aspect of Joseph's past and the present moment in Europe at that time. Mm-hmm.
This is where I sat on my very first visit to Bewley's 3 years ago. You cannot imagine the horrors I left behind, the bureaucratic hoops I had to jump through just to get to this point. This little country of yours has provided very few people with sanctuary. They make it very difficult. I had just landed in a new country knowing absolutely nobody. All I knew was that this Grafton Street was the Kärntner Straße of Dublin. I was feeling overwhelmed. And then I saw Bewley's Cafe all lit up and it seemed to pull me in. The mahogany, the marble tables, the lighting, the clattering of spoons and saucers and coffee cups. All this made me think back to happier days in the Café Sperl, the favourite café of artists and archdukes, princes and paupers. So many different coffees. And the cakes, oh, Schokoladenschnitte, Apfelstrudel, Topfenstrudel, Sachertort. Oh, it was really amazing. And I was the head waiter overseeing the entire operation. They say that this infamous failed artist used to come into the café around 1913, the very same man that is now destroying the continent.
That's Rory Lenehan there with a section from the play Emergency. Rory with me in studio here in Dublin, and Sam Ford, the writer, joining us down the line. Obviously a reference there to Adolf Hitler in terms of the infamous failed artist who used to come into the place around 1913. I'm guessing, did you have to go to Vienna to research all those cakes, Sam, or did you manage to persuade some of the chefs in Bewley's to bake them for you so that you could research that way?
Well, would you believe I went off on a 2-year mission to Vienna and I gained a tremendous amount of weight trying all sorts of cakes in all sorts of cafes. But no, I wouldn't believe that for two years.
You did live there, did you?
I lived there for 2 years, yeah. So I met a lot of grumpy Viennese waiters. You know, that in Ireland we say the customer is always right. In Vienna they say der Kellner ist König, which means the waiter is the king. So it was a lot of fun to write a kind of slightly grumpy, fussy kind of a character like that. And Rory does it great justice.
Yeah, there's a bit of fun knocked out of it because he's an Austrian, is Josef. So he simply cannot understand something like, I'll see you in a few minutes' time.
Oh, yeah, something like
he doesn't understand,
yeah. And he's dealing with a lot, you know. They're using potato in the dough, for God's sake. And they're, you know, the turf they're getting from the Dublin Mountains is wet. So he's putting up with a lot. And he's doing his best. And what's great about the piece is after all the walking around, you end up back in the cafe and the audience is treated to a selection of really beautiful luxury cakes and teas and coffees and whatnot.
Yeah, so that's part of your ticket as you do it. I was asking too, Rory, just before we came to air, I was wondering, because this is, you're walking around the place, you go out onto the street, you're going out onto 2023 Grafton Street.
That's the one, yeah.
How do you stay in 1941 mode when you go out there?
It's great. I mean, the character is so kind of stiff and really, you know, he's really stuck in this his own mannerisms that it's really lovely
to stay.
Yeah, and I actually warn the audience as we cross Grafton Street to beware of the horses and the horse leavings, you know, and to take a moment to look around us. But no, it's nice, you know, you get to bounce off the public and deal with the amps and the buskers on Grafton Street as well, you know.
And in terms, Sam, just to finish up, you were mentioning the parallels that you saw as you were writing this with stuff happening in Europe right now. Do you draw any of those out a bit further in the script, or do you just hope that people will see them and pick them up for themselves? What was your feeling on all of that?
They just sort of happened fairly naturally. And I think a lot of the reviewers that come in to see it sort of did more of the work, and a lot of the audiences did more of the work of finding the parallels. But I suppose the big difference is that back then we took so few, as you heard in that piece.
Yeah.
But now we actually have done a great thing. I mean, more than 70,000 Ukrainian refugees have actually found sanctuary in Ireland. So that's a great thing. Who knows what kind of culinary delights that they may cook up for us.
Yeah, the equivalent of Mary's cake. Mary's cake was she the mother or the wife of the Hungarian waiter?
So it's an interesting one. The actual Hungarian refugee was not called Mary. He was a man. But the head waiter of Bewley's at the time was a guy called Alfred. And he decided that this young lad's cake was going to be a fixture. But the cost that he exacted was he demanded that it then be named after his wife.
She
was Mary.
Yeah, right, okay.
So the head waiter who was overseeing this young Hungarian, he named the cake after his wife.
There you go. That's the history of Mary's Cake. Thanks so much to both of you for being with us this evening.
Cheers.
That's Sam Ford joining us on the line and Rory Hennan with us in studio this evening. Emergency is at Beauty's Cafe until the 9th of August. Two shows every Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, 2:30 p.m. and 4:30 p.m. About 12 or thereabouts in the audience each time, something in around that, Rory. You'll find full details on beautyscafetheatre.com. And so to our album reviews on this Friday evening. First up will be PJ Harvey, Polly Jean Harvey MBE to you and me. For over three decades since her debut album Dry, she's been the darling of music critics. Today she brings us her 10th studio album inspired by her own epic poem, Orlam. The album is called I Inside the Old Year Dying. Next up, Anoni and the Johnsons, the band founded by Anthony Hegarty around the turn of the century, originally named Anthony and the Johnsons. The first album with her new moniker, Anoni and the Johnsons, is released today and entitled My Back Was a Bridge for You to Cross. And continuing the long album title week that we are in, a five-decade career spanning blues, Americana and country, Lucinda Williams has become one of the most beloved artists in her field. And this is reflected in many ways, but certainly by her recruitment of Bruce Springsteen to provide, yes, backing vocals on the lead single from the album New York Comeback. And again, the title here, Stories from a Rock and Roll Heart. Eamon Sweeney and Nadine O'Regan have been listening to all three albums. We'll start with PJ Harvey and a track from the album called Prayer at the Gate. Opening track, I think, yes.
As childhood died, the audience the soldier appeared, the ashen bar night and day.
And that the opening track, a track called Prayer at the Gate from I Inside the Old Year Dying from PJ Harvey. As I said, Eamon Sweeney and Nadine O'Regan are two reviewers on this Friday afternoon. She's gone to her own, now she's gone to literature on numerous occasions, Nadine, but she's gone to her own poetry for the inspiration for this album.
Yeah, she's been publishing poetry in recent years, and Orlam is a book that she came out with last year. Eamon actually has the copy sitting next to us on the desk. It's a beautiful edition published by Picador Poetry, and I think probably has found... It'd be fair to say perhaps a niche audience. Poetry is niche anyway, but this is the kind of poetry that... needs a lot of work to be, I suppose, thoroughly investigated, because what she has done is she's gone back to her origins in Dorset and she has dug up words that are no longer used. Really interesting words that sound kind of cool in the mouth, you know, words like Chollywise and Reddick and all these kinds of words where you'd be thinking, well, what's that? And then she's taken some of the poetry from this book and she's essentially used it as the bedrock for the new album.
Is she telling, because it did kind of strike me, is there a touch of the concept album off it? Are we getting the life story of PJ Harvey or of this young girl who's called Ira Abel Rawls? Is that how we say it?
Yes.
Or Rawls, perhaps?
Ira is the story. It's Ira's story in both the album and the book.
Yeah.
And it kind
the book
of starts.
Is beautiful.
Yeah, the book is absolutely beautiful. And for anybody, it's the first significant work in Dorset dialect in literature for decades as well. So I think even leaving this album aside, for that fact alone, it's pretty astonishing that Polly Jean Harvey can also do that. But I think this works incredibly well as a companion piece to the book. And
when
the book
I say it's beautiful, I'm looking at it. I haven't read it, so
I
should qualify
it's a gorgeous
that.
Edition, yeah.
Yeah, it does look beautiful, yeah.
And I think the album is beautiful. Now, look, it's not for everybody. Should I say, you know, it's not the Polly Jean Harvey of the early 90s or even the early noughties of the Stories from the City, Stories from the Sea album. But it's still fantastic.
Her voice is a very different voice from what I was expecting. Certainly on that track.
Yeah. I struggle a little bit with the PJ Harvey of now, and that's not in any way to disrespect the artistry, because certainly she is someone who is consistently reinvented herself, who's very brave and will move in ways that you won't expect. But the fact is, when she started out back in 92, 93, she had a stridency in her voice and an urgency, and the songs themselves were quite skeletal but very elemental. There was just tremendous force there, and there was this kind of proto-feminist about her, and lyrics, you know, from tracks like Dry. I was saying to Eamon outside the studio, you know, as a sort of a teen listening to them, and she was talking about this idea of putting on a dress, would she put it on, and would she put on everything that came with the dress. And she questioned our assumptions, she questioned stereotypes, and that was fascinating for so many people, myself included. And I followed her album after album after album, albums like Is This Desire, stunning work, and then came Stories from the City, Stories from the Sea, which I found a little bit trickier because it was so influenced, I think, by Patti Smith, and I started to think, oh, you know, is she sort of becoming quite a different artist? And now we get to this, where her vocal, as you mentioned, has become quite different. It's thin, it's reedy, it's plaintive, and it's kind of quivering at certain points, and it's not as nice an instrument potentially as it was.
I'm usually thinking of Let England Shake. I remember that album in 2010 when I thought there was real grit and anger in there. This is a more esoteric, ethereal type of sound. Let's have a listen to another track, one here called A Child's Question, August. In fact, that track is called August from PJ Harvey's new album, Eye Inside the Old You're Dying. But there's a track called August, there's a track called A Child's Question, August, there's a track called A Child's Question, July, and Eye Inside the Old You're Dying. I mean, it is quite confusing. And Eamon, I take your point. You have the book. I'm wondering, do you need to have the two things kind of to really get
possibly
to come to grips
it's certainly
with this?
It certainly really enhanced my appreciation of it. And I've like the chorus of that song, I think it's amazing that it's a single. Those words are like drush being trush, and dunnock means sparrow, where of course we call them dunnocks over here, and it's spelled completely differently. So yes, you do benefit. It's one of those records now, and I said this probably would put the fear of God into a lot of people. The more you put into it, the more you get out of it, in a way. You know?
Now, so stars from you on it, first of all, Eamon?
4.5.
4.5. So it's a very high bar you're setting there. You come to this as a big PJ Harvey fan, but kind of, are you wavering a bit, Nadine?
For me, the lyrics are so opaque. You know, one reviewer actually called it inscrutable. And I think she's a big artist who, in a way, wants to be a smaller artist with a smaller audience and be respected for that. But I need the connection that more genuinely direct lyrics can offer. So for me, sonically, I really appreciate it. It's a headphones album. Don't listen to it in the car. 3.5 stars.
3.5 from you. Okay, let's move on then to Anoni and the Johnsons. Anoni Hegarty, British singer-songwriter, leader of the New York-based collective Anoni and the Johnsons. 2005, she won the Mercury Prize for her second album, I Am a Bird Now, and now she's back with her first full-length album in 7 years, My Back Was a Bridge for You to Cross. Let's have a listen to a track, actually, first of all. A track, again, this is the opening track, It Must Change. Little section there of It Must Change, opening track on another long-titled album, My Back Was a Bridge for You to Cross, from Anoni and the Johnsons. And she really lays out the stall for what the album is doing here in that, with the statement, It Must Change.
Absolutely.
Eamon.
Absolutely. Reminds me of Marvin Gaye's classic, What's Going On. And I think in many ways, this album is a similar record for the closing years of the first quarter of the 21st century. And looking specifically at things that kind of equality and the challenges and struggle for respect and recognition that she and all transgender people are facing right now. And her voice is just astonishing. We've just been saying that, yeah, you know.
The voice is just, no matter how many times you hear it, it's an undefinable voice, in fact, in many ways, isn't it?
Yeah, her voice is timeless. And I was thinking about this when I came to the record, you know, fashions come and go, genres dip and dive, and yet she emerges with this record where all in a way she has to do is keep a classic, because with a vocal like that, with an instrument like that, it will transcend anything you can throw at it. Yeah,
because Eamon was talking about Marvin Gaye. There are times when it's a soul record from the 70s.
Yeah, and actually, musically, the bedrock of the record is nice and floaty, and there's some very simple guitar, simple kind of brush drum strokes, and it's all there just to illuminate and add, I guess, just that lovely bedrock quality to that vocal. One thing I would say is lyrically, there are some tracks here that are really, really bruising emotionally. There's a track, Scapegoat, where she sings, "You're so killable, just so killable. It's not personal. It's just the way you were born. And in this society, a scapegoat is all I can be. I can say just what I want. I can use you like a toilet." And you can hear the actual pain in those words. And that track is one of the best, I think, on the record.
Yeah, let's listen, because what struck me was, you know, sometimes when an activist, or it's not that it's an activist record, but a record, there can be a certain amount of anger in it. I don't hear anger here. I hear real pain. And you could understand anger, but pain is what you hear.
You're so killable, just so killable. It's not personal, it's just the way you were born.
I just wanted to let that develop a little bit. That's Anoni and the Johnsons and the song Scapegoat from her album My Back Was a Bridge for You to Cross. And while a lot of the songs have a very pared back aspect to them, and the lyrics that Nadine gave us going into that, it's quite right that there's nothing to cover over those lyrics. They're very clearly heard.
Absolutely.
But then it broadens out, and I was always looking at the song Rest, which is a bit further down, 6 or 7 minute song, builds to this huge electric guitar solo. So it isn't all just, little quiet guitar noodlings.
It's very cleverly and very beautifully done, beautifully crafted. And we've spoken a lot about the words and the lyrics, but sonically, you know, obviously her voice is that trump card, but there's so much else going on. And also, I think it's supposed to kind of a spiritual connection to the late Lou Reed, Sliver of Ice track.
Yeah.
It's apparently the final words that Lou Reed said to Anoni, of "I'm going to be gone soon," and so on. And, you know, Lou Reed was so important in giving her kind of a leg up as a backing.
Yeah, and then the constant lyric in Sliver of Ice, I think it's repeated, I don't know, many times it's repeated, "I love you so much, never before," and I never knew it before. It's hugely, it kind of speaks.
Stuff.
And Eamon, touching on the musical quality that's on the album, Nadine, the main collaborator here, Scottish guitarist and producer Jimmy Hogarth, what kind of sound has been produced here?
Well, I genuinely think that they're aiming for the generations. It's simple, it's classic, and the point is to foreground the lyrics, foreground that vocal. One slight drawback, I would say, is that because every track is, I think almost without exception, every track is very downbeat in terms of its lyrics. As a listen, in a way, it's actually more of a room album, because if you listen in the headphones and you hear those words, and she's also talking about, you know, the ravages of the earth, environmentalism and alienation, over track after track, you can get very wound up in that. Whereas when you hear the room and you hear the guitars, you hear the instrumentation sort of more, you can kind of get the balance right. So,
but it's a room late at night.
It's a room. It's still a room late at night. But this is an album with layers, and I think that her fans are going to be so happy with this record.
Yeah, and might even bring new fans in,
I think so,
as well.
Yeah.
Stars from you on this one first, Nadine?
4.
4. What are you saying, Eamon?
I would echo that. 4. It's a fabulous record. Do you know what? I'll go 4.5. It's
going 4.5.
Unbelievably, I am enjoying and getting as much out of it as the PJ Harvey record. It's been a great week for albums.
Okay, let us move on then to album number three, Stories from a Rock and Roll Heart. Lucinda Williams, well, that's a rock and roll heart. And she has a big story to tell, and particularly in recent times, Nadine.
Yeah, she suffered from a stroke, actually. I think it was back in November 2020, and her motor skills were affected. She lost the ability to play the guitar. Now, her vocal wasn't particularly affected, but she's now not really playing guitar other than sort of here and there, if you like. And this album is only available, as far as I'm aware, in record shops. It's not on Spotify.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, it feels like this is a record where she's, you know, she's a veteran. She is revered by so many people. She's released classic albums and she deserves everything, really. And I think her colleagues in the rock and roll world have just gathered around her. Bruce Springsteen is on this record and Patty. And there's Angel Olsen is there as well. And you can almost feel, because this record is all about people singing in a room. It's not necessarily about perfect songs, you know, perfect sound. Mm-hmm. There are little blips here and there, and that almost adds to the authenticity in the same way that when Johnny Cash, you know, aged and delivered tracks where you could hear the crack, almost better.
Listen to her call to her pals at the beginning. The opening track is "Let's Get the Band Back Together." And you'll only need three chords to get the band back together. You won't need anything more than that. And
straight
let's face
up,
it,
direct.
She's not going to change the world. And the music here isn't going to change the world. But rock and roll changed the world 50 years ago or more. So it doesn't matter.
But if it's still making us happy. It's still making us dance. It's putting a silly, goofy grin on our faces on a Friday night.
We were all bopping along.
So, you know, so job done. As far, you know, kind of, as far as I'm concerned.
She said as well she wanted to be inspired by Tom Petty in this record because she had played, I think, support to him before and he'd been very, very good to her during her career. And she said that she actually genuinely found it very difficult to write the kind of records that he was able to write where it seems so simple and yet
go give it a go. See if you can it's only three chords. Well, off you go and write a three chord song so and see how you get on. The other thing is about, you know, there's a real rock and roll feel off that, and a rock and roll feel off other tracks. But also, I suppose, is she classed as a country artist essentially, or how do you class or put what box do you put her into if you're going to do
question.
That?
I would have actually kind of, before I heard this record, in my head kind of made a slightly lazy assumption that she'd be more country than rock and roll.
Yeah.
But this, I think, is more rock and roll than country, you know. And look, Stories from a Rock and Roll Heart, it does what it says in the tin, you know, of any of the titles of the long titles of this week. It's country rock with Bruce Springsteen on backing vocals. What could go wrong there?
Yeah, absolutely. And let's go to a little bit further down because we cannot go past without. How do you get Bruce Springsteen to be the backing vocalist on your album?
Yeah, she met him. I think it wasn't even like they're not like friends since the year dot, but I think they had a mutual admiration society. Sent him the songs, and apparently he and Patty sent back 16 different vocals that she could use. And she said in an interview at Rolling Stone that even now when she hears his voice coming in, she's like, whoa.
and you know, so after Let's Get the Band Back Together, then New York Comeback is the second track in the album. And that's the first time we hear Bruce and Patty. And let's listen to a bit of that.
The crowd dies down to a silent hush, and everyone heads for the doors. Everybody wants to beat the rush. There's nothing left to see anymore.
There you go. You get Bruce Springsteen to do the backing vocals on your course. That's Lucinda Williams and New York Comeback from Stories from a Rock and Roll Heart. But I was saying, Nadine, as we listen to that, it kind of is. This is an album made to be done like a show, kind of telling her story in some ways.
And she said she was unsure about the title of the record, Stories from Rock and Roll Heart, because she was afraid that fans would think it was a bit like Car Wheels and Gravel Road, that she was going to tell very strong narrative-based stories. And she's not really trying to do that for most of the album here. It is about having a good time and telling, you know, and delivering those songs. And yet, at the same time, I really felt that there were moments on the record where you can feel her isolation after the stroke. She talks about the walls closing in on her. She can't get out of the house. And there's a line, it's just so pragmatic. She goes, you know, there's a bar at the end of the road. I don't need to drive to get there. It's really handy. Yeah. And there's a jukebox.
the last two, so the Hums of Liquor is the third last song, which is the story of a friend who died from alcoholism. But the second last song, where the song will find me.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
So it's about music finding her, rather, and it's just so touching. She's, 6.5 minutes.
PJ Harvey isn't sure and hasn't been sure if she wanted to be in music continually, and there's been that unrest with her. And Lucinda Williams is so different because she's literally grabbing the mic with both hands and she's saying, I want to be here, I want this.
And
I love that.
And the final track called Never Gonna Fade Away. If you you're putting it down,
what you want. It's
Stars from you, Nadine.
Four.
Four from you. What are you saying?
Won't go quite that far, but it is a very strong record. 3.5.
3.5 from Eamon. That's Eamon Sweeney, Nadine O'Regan, and the three albums this evening. I need a minute and a half of this. Lucinda Williams' Story from a Rock and Roll Heart, and only in the Johnsons' My Back Was a Bridge for You to Cross, and PJ Harvey, I Inside the Old Year Dying. Just a reminder that we will be in Galway too, broadcasting from there two shows on July the 20th and 21st, but I really want to remind you about July the 27th, Thursday, when we have an audience with Druid Theatre Company at the Town Hall celebrating their production of Druid O'Casey. That's the three big Sean O'Casey, the Dublin Trilogy, The Plough and the Stars, The Shadow of a Gunman, Juno and the Peacock, which Druid are doing. At 3 p.m. on July the 27th, we will be on the stage of the Town Hall with the creative team behind the production, director Gary Hines. The cast of the play will be there, Catherine Walsh, Marty Ray, Rory Nolan, Hilda Fay and Zara Devlin. We'll be talking about the entire process of putting this great trilogy of plays together. That's an Arena Druid O'Casey special from the Town Hall Theatre in Galway, Thursday, July the 27th, 3 to 4 p.m. You can be part of it if you want to be. If you want to find out how to do that, go to get your ticket, go to druid.ie. And that is our lot for this Friday evening. Paula Shields and Amandine Paso Divide researched. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Harry Bookless was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Ola McGowan. Talk to you on Monday at 7 here on RT Radio 1. Join me on Lyric at 1 o'clock on Sunday if you're looking for an afternoon of music. Have a great weekend. In the meantime, John Creedon will be with you after the news.